Isn't he always?
So
isn't
funny. He always?
Let's all laugh.
Oh, let's laugh at Kunin, the guy with the show on his back, just holding it up like Atlas holds up the sky.
That's true.
That's fine. I think I'm still a little hot here.
You were definitely hot.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah,
hot with that new haircut, I gotta say. All
right, for the listeners, I have to say this now, Will yeah. and Zach.
Mm-hmm.
Zach was offended.
Yeah.
He wasn't being referred to as a listener, so shout out to Zach.
Well, I met Will in the wild.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. true.
I had a Will wild encounter. Mm-hmm.
They were
crazy.
They just both happened to be cowboys herding sheep on a mountain. You know, something about how one of them couldn't quit the other. I don't know. I didn't catch it all. I'm sorry. We're doing 2008 jokes, I believe. I forget when that movie came out.
I think it's before that.
2006.
Jesus Christ, I'm old.
Yeah. It's crazy.
Well, yeah, we got to meet Will. How was it?
It was good. He was a lot different than I expected.
Yeah.
Like you said, he was a lot more handsome.
Will, you're a lot more handsome than I thought you were.
We expected our average listener to be definitely fatter.
Yeah. I expected you to have seen.
You're very svelte, Will.
I assumed you had seen less sunshine than you've seen.
Yeah, paler.
What else can we cue the listener into? It's 100,000 degrees in here.
Also, speaking of Will, the listener, he wanted me to convey to you, Kunin, two corrections. Specifically to you.
Corrections, yeah.
One is that Keanu Reeves was not in Any Given Sunday.
He was in The Replacements.
Yep.
I know. I fucking edit really? The podcast.
Okay, we're fact-checking Kunin.
And secondly, he just wanted to reinforce the fact that I was right about what a sextant does. It does measure the sun, but it also measures the stars. You asked him to look it up.
Oh.
So I was right.
Sextant?
Yeah, it's a device for navigating at sea.
Has that like hoop with the eyepiece through it?
Yeah, it looks like this.
Oh, yeah.
For Zach and Will,
Michael had a picture of a sextant up on his phone way quicker than I thought anyone could do that.
No, I had primed it. I had primed it for this. You know,
for fact checking, Kunin. For
fact checking, yeah.
I feel attacked.
Well, Kunin, are you going to go for clean today, or are we going dirty?
No. I feel like I've proven everything.
You proved. Okay, you accomplished your goal.
Yep. Today.
And I feel like the sound's a little off.
Oh, did it go bad? Ah, damn it.
I think you lowered me a little bit.
Yeah, I did.
Is it the breathing?
No. I lowered all of us, but I think I just needed to lower me and Michael. All right, Michael, give me a...
There we go. That's
check.
Yeah, thank you. That's check, not check. Helpful at all. Give me a sound check. wait, can you do that again? Yeah, I'll give you a sound. Oh, dude, John Paul Jones.
John Paul Jones.
Sound check. I'm tired of a sound check. Oh, there's a breeze up me kilt. All right. Did he wear a kilt, by the way?
No, because the British outlawed kilts for a brief period. Right after. So remember, he was born in 1747.
Right. Oh, after that. And that rebellion. That revolt, yeah.
Yeah, that last revolt, they outlawed them for a little while.
Mm.
And
not long enough, apparently.
No. You know, by the 1770s, British Scottish troops in the British Army are wearing kilts again.
Mm.
But so, you know,
do they freeball?
Yeah. Now
every time.
Yeah.
It actually really helped during World War I.
Did what?
No, it didn't help. In the
trenches, best to be freeball.
No, they were all wearing commando? Pants. They were all wearing pants pretty quick.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because
when rats chew on your nuts, you decide kilts aren't worth it anymore.
Or like, or even in the American, like,
what's hot? Chewing on me, Bloomberg. Oh, it's a rat. Tell the British to send us a fucking panzer.
Wait, so the kilts were meant for battle mainly? Is that originally
it's a marker of Scottish identity.
Okay.
And so the reason the British had outlawed them in the aftermath of the 1745 rebellion was to suppress as much as possible Scottish national identity.
Yeah.
And by the 1770s, like if you were in a an army regiment raised in Scotland, the British army, the British government was like, okay, we can throw you sort of the sop of you get to wear your kilt because you're in the British army, right? Like, we've pretty thoroughly aligned you to the state. You can have your kilts.
Did they replace them with British wear?
Or they called them like, oh boys, this no, is no, where like we
to wear knickers or something.
Oh boys, kilts is where we hide our Englishmen clubbing clubs.
Also known as bagpipes.
Yeah. What's typical 1700s British wear?
Breeches.
Oh, breeches. They were mandated to wear breeches.
You know, this is Dr. History Sage Scholar being a giant, giant nerd. by the middle of the American Revolution, again, just in North America, most British soldiers started to wear, because nobody really wore what we would call trousers, like pants, in the 1700s.
Way too much access to your penis. That's what I heard on a
it wasn't really a thing. So British Army soldiers wore breeches that went down to, like, just below their knee, and then they wore high, like, essentially stockings, and then they wore over their shoes, they wore what were called gaiters, which was to,
they still have gaiters.
Yeah, but, like, they had to wear those because otherwise rocks and stuff would get in your shoes. Right? Yeah, so, like, it turned the shoe into a boot, stupidly.
Yeah.
Now, by the middle
you could just wear boots, though. Yeah,
but they didn't want to do that. Yeah. That would have been too easy. So by the middle of the war, what they were wearing was, like, a kind of overall trouser-gaiter combination.
Trouser-gaiter.
So it was a pair of pants that went all the way down, but they included the gaiters, so, like, you had to put your shoes on before you put your pants on.
Man, it's like the 17th century version of, like, cargo shorts with the zip-off pants. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Yeah.
and so they would wear that, and it was sort of... because what they found was that... marching through the wilderness of North America in uniforms designed for Northwest Europe just didn't work.
Right.
And so the British, you know, one person I saw on the internet, a comment was, you know, someone was asking the question, like, how did the British change their army uniforms for the war in North America? And it was someone's comment, somewhat tongue-in-cheek. I don't think they literally did this, but they're like, take the full dress uniform, march through the woods, and cut off anything that got stuck on a tree. Right? Just slice off everything that got stuck on a tree, and you've got it. It was a very...
So no more tails.
They did actually cut off the back of the bottom of their coats, but they cut those off sometimes to produce more material to fix holes, right? Like, because American privateers kept stealing British uniform shipments. So they're like, well, if we cut off the bottom of the coat, which we don't need, we now have a bunch of extra red cloth to sew up holes in the rest of the coat.
They also should have reconsidered the color of their uniform. Wow.
Otherwise, how do they know you're brave in the face of death?
Nothing sticks out like red.
You know, and the question of that is, like, Once you've added so much gunpowder smoke, it doesn't matter.
Really?
Also, there's the fact that, like, a musket in the 1700s at 100 yards, you might hit the target. Inaccurate. You might hit the target every other time at 100 yards. At 50 yards, you could do it. And then the muzzle velocity is so low that, like, they're wool coats. They're heavy wool coats. Past 100 yards, even if you hit someone with a musket, the muzzle velocity was so low that the bullet might not actually punch through all of the clothing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, like, especially, again, because it's so much heavy wool, right? You know, these are not...
What about depleted uranium rounds?
Oh, those go through everything.
I would love to see a depleted uranium musket rounds. Bomb. What's that?
Depleted uranium rounds?
All of the... you didn't know that? U.S. Army armor-piercing weapons all use depleted uranium in the front.
Currently?
Yes, because it's hyper-dense, so it punches through armor faster.
Yeah, it also leads to lots of birth defects.
Common knowledge? Like
yeah.
Oh, I mean...
in this room, two out of three people know.
Yeah, two out of three.
Listeners, I'm looking
two at... Two out of three history nerds know that...
So I've come to a crossroads in my life. because I'm looking at Dr. History and I'm looking at Adam Lax and I'm like, which side do I want to be on? It's
Darth Vader at the end of the getting thrown down the elevator?
I've already said I'll worship you as a history deity.
That's true. So does that make Lax the emperor and you're going to throw him down a shaft?
I think it makes him Satan, actually. And he's already fallen. Should I not? You know what?
Is this about me being Jewish?
You make everything about you. Oh, Adam says I'm too much of a penny pincher. Oh, Adam says my nose is too long. Oh, Adam says I don't belong in a Christian city. Why do you gotta say everything's about you being Jewish? God. Oh, Adam says I poison wells. Just what?
Baby blood, yes.
It's not all about being Jewish, all right? So take that back, you space laser. all right. Well, on that anti-Semitism, do you think we should get this episode started?
That's right. All right.
I'm sorry.
You're listening to Laughing Historically with Adam Lax, Adam Cooney, and Dr. History Scholar.
Welcome to Laughing Historically. I'm your host, Adam Lax, and on the ones and twos, we got Adam Coonan.
Hey-o.
And we've got Dr. History Sage Scholar.
Woo-hoo.
That's it.
Awesome.
All right.
I have been stripped of most of my titles. That's okay.
You got to earn them back.
No. I actually refer to you as, I'm trying to think of a historogron, and it's the deity of history that lives within all of us.
Yeah, I love how Dr. Sage Scholar is waiting for his other titles. He's like, and?
Slayer of ignorance, decider of fates, judger of military capacity at certain dates at certain times.
Speaking of that.
All right.
Everybody doing good today?
Doing pretty well. Yeah.
What should we, other than it's Memorial Day.
It's
weekend.
Memorial Day weekend.
Yeah. It is. So pretty hard to get places.
Yeah.
In Washington D.C. because
all of those motorcycles everywhere.
So many motorcycles.
Yeah. Motorcycles.
Yeah.
What's up with that?
A lot of tourists that don't have sleeves on any of their shirts.
No notes.
Very decidedly Midwest looking tourist.
How dare you? There are whole other sections of the country that suck worse. They could have been the West. They could have been the South. They could have been the Southwest.
It's true.
We get all the hate, goddamn. I think it's because we count during elections.
It's true. A little too much. But
also, we should tell the listener, though, you revealed it pre-show. Adam Lax has H1N1 today, so it's going to be pretty hard for me to
edit. I brought enough for the rest of the class, okay?
Yeah, so if you hear sniffling, coughing, or the sound of blood coming out of one's eyes, it's Adam Lax. He's not feeling really good.
The blood coming out of someone's eyes might be me responding to something one of you two said.
Okay.
Most likely Coonan.
Hey, you just say things. I feel like you just say things. All right. Let's do it. Piling on Coonan today. Right? All right. That's how it's going.
And on that note, this day in history with Dr. History's Aid Scholar.
So today is May 26th. And so for this part three of John Paul Jones, I have just one, which is on this day, enemy of the pod, Andrew, I am the third worst president, Johnson, was acquitted in the Senate by exactly one vote. So if you want to know
more.
Who
was that vote?
I don't know who the vote was. But there were multiple Republicans who voted no. So like, for instance, I know one of the ones that voted no was William Tecumseh Sherman's brother, John Sherman, of the Sherman Antitrust Act. Same Sherman.
Oh.
He was in the Senate at the time, and he voted to acquit. And I can't remember exactly his reasoning. He wrote it down somewhere.
There's probably some other thing he needed or whatever. Or like, yeah.
I mean, the grounds of impeachment were kind of weird. Yeah, it was kind of a weird case,
it
right?
It was. It's pretty... the act, if and for the listeners, both Zach and Will, if you really want to know, you can go back to our episode on the five worst presidents.
All right,
but it basically, like the
we
law.
We did an episode on the five worst presidents.
but the law that he is supposed to have broken is probably unconstitutional in and of itself. Mm. So it's weird. They like laid a trap.
It was a gotcha thing.
It was also like, this was May of 1868. The election's in November. Andrew Johnson's not on the ballot. Yeah. So
he was a lame duck.
Yeah, really. There were Republicans who were like, why am I voting yes to impeach the guy when Ulysses S. Grant is going to mop the floor with whoever the Democrats nominate?
Yeah, yeah.
It's not worth it, as it were.
Who was Andrew Johnson's vice president?
He didn't have one. There was no mechanism in the Constitution as written for replacing the vice president if the president dies. So it isn't until, I think, the 25th Amendment or so, that it's not until the 20th century that we come up with a constitution. Like, we had to amend the Constitution to be like, and this is what you do if the president dies and the vice president becomes president. This is how you replace the vice president.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't have that. So, no, he didn't have a vice president while he was in office, which is why the head of the Senate, Benjamin Wade of Ohio, would have become president if he had been impeached. But yeah, so
damn deep cuts again from Dr. History God Scholar.
There's Dr. one. History God Scholar. I appreciate that one.
Okay, so shall we begin?
Yeah, let's go.
So part three, unremitting fury.
Just to remind the listeners, part three of what?
John Paul Jones.
So
the last time we talked about John Paul Jones, he had failed to abduct the Earl of Selkirk and had stolen Lady Selkirk's
silverware. Yeah, she was very bristled. They bristled. Mm-hmm. He bristled some British, actually. Mm-hmm. Gave him a good bristling.
Give a bristling of a lifetime.
Yeah. We're a bit bristled now. I definitely believe this is a good bristling, John Paul Jones.
So 1779 was to be the greatest year of John Paul Jones's life, at least in terms of fame and glory.
Oh.
It did not start out that way. In the late winter of 1779, Jones, along with Lafayette, planned a raid on the British coast. However, King Louis XVI canceled the raid and sent Lafayette back to America. So Lafayette had come back from America. And in this, at a certain point, he and Jones were like, okay, we'll raid the British coast, because Jones is always up for raiding the British coast.
Yeah, yeah. I'm kind of always up for that, too. But I don't really have the means or methods to raid the British coast.
It.
Yeah.
So Louis XVI.
Get a Somali ship.
I'm the captain, though.
So Louis XVI cancels the raid, sends Lafayette back to America. Instead, Louis orders a full-scale invasion of southern England. Okay, that's his plan instead. He's like, you guys are thinking too small.
Yeah, let's D-Day this shit. We're going to fucking...
Now, the invasion force would consist of 40,000 French troops to be escorted by 64 French and Spanish ships of the line. So remember, for the listeners, ship of the line has over 50 guns on it. Wow. So this is a massive force. Now, Jones gained a squadron. He's going to command a group of ships, and thus the right to call himself a commodore.
Ooh.
Right? It would consist of the 30...
I'm a commodore!
Yeah, I think that's what he
commodore.
Said.
I'm commodore. I'm the best commodore you've ever seen. It's like every rank he gets is just funnier. Like, it's just, no, I'm an admiral. Like, oh, pat.
Is that
pat.
Like second to admiral?
Yes, it is a rank that, like, the current U.S. Navy doesn't use the rank of commodore. It's used it occasionally in the past, like during World War II, it used it. It's the rank between captain and admiral.
Oh.
And the reason for its use during World War II was that the Navy needed more officers who could command groups of ships, but it didn't want to create a bunch of admirals on the off chance that they would still be admirals when the war ended, right? Like, you know, some guy who had, you know, decent enough sailor, right? Decent enough officer, but it's like your pay scales are different when you're an admiral than if you're a commodore. So a lot of, like, reservists officers became commodores during the war so they could command a group of ships and outrank all of the captains of the other ships.
And also not get paid that much.
But not, lowballing the the draftees, essentially.
Well, did they get a like a promotion without a pay raise kind of thing? Like at a company? I mean, like now you are an executive senior head of sales. Like, what does that mean? They're like, nothing. More responsibility.
Same pay. That we always wanted.
Yeah.
There'll be, you get to go to 1.5 pizza parties. I mean, the military used to have the rank of, used to have brevet ranks, B-R-E-V-E-T, and it is promotion to a rank without pay. So you get to hold the rank, but you don't actually have the rank in terms of pay.
Oh.
So you, like, for instance, you'll read...
Brevet, it sounds like a Cockney thing.
Yeah. It's
I, not brevet.
I think it's, I honestly think it's us mispronouncing something out of French. It's probably, it should probably
be brevet.
But, you know, we were like, no, it's brevet.
French.
So like when
to our French listeners,
we don't care.
Yeah, let us know. But, you know, if it's in French, we're not going to translate.
So now Jones's squadron would consist of the 36 gun frigate Alliance.
Nice.
The 32 gun converted merchantman Pallas. A 12-gun brig, the Vengeance, and an 18-gun cutter, Seraph, C-E-R-F. Jones would get a brand new ship to command this fleet. When asked by a French...
Oh, goody, I get a brand new ship. Is it my birthday?
No. Anyway, when asked by a French
official... In this household, we don't celebrate your birthday.
No, Father, no.
All right.
When asked by...
I don't know if for the listeners, he had a very abusive household because he was the bastard son of
of upper gentry. Lower gentry.
Yeah, lower gentry. Yeah. And his gardener...
His dad, her dad got cuckolded.
Maybe. We're not sure.
I want to believe. Yeah. I never trust a gardener. Mm-hmm. You know.
When asked by a French official what kind of ship he wanted, Jones responded that he wanted to quote, have no connection with any ship that does not sail fast, for I intend to go into harm's way, end quote. What he got was the Bonhomme Richard. So the Bonhomme Richard might be the perfect... I'll explain
The Butthole Richard?
Yes.
That's what you heard, though, right?
The Bonhomme... Bonhomme
Richard.
Bonhomme.
Doesn't sound like anything.
Bonhomme?
Bonhomme. B-O-N-H-O-M-M-E.
B-U-T-T-H-O-M-M-E.
Well, that's French.
I can spell too, all right.
Bonhomme? How's your French?
The Bonhomme.
How's your French?
My French?
Yeah. Good man.
Yeah, I but like...
How is... It's a French word.
Bonhomme?
We're all practicing.
Now
you've gone Middle Eastern.
So
you gotta.
France had a footprint over there. Oh,
so the Bonhomme Richard.
You know, French is actually just Arabic in disguise, right?
I don't think that's true.
It's common knowledge.
Just like depleted uranium rounds.
Yeah, go on depleted uranium rounds.
And French
as Arabs.
You guys just go on
Arabs.
Go on any number of Facebook groups that are
subreddits.
Subreddits. You'll actually get good information on subreddits. Facebook groups are just it's housewives.
Some subreddits.
There's no subreddits, you fucking idiot.
Get your sorry, that's on 4chan. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah, I don't know. I don't know shit about 4chan. I don't
8chan,
know.
What are they at now? 12chan.
Yeah, 24chan. It goes up like bits. All right, I'm sorry. What's up? How is John Paul Jones currently
what happened
trying to
this
make up
invasion?
For his lack of masculinity?
Yeah, so the Bonhomme Richard might be the perfect encapsulation of French aid to America in the Revolution. It was a deceptively grand, deeply self-interested gesture that Americans made do with and the French took credit for. The Bonhomme Richard started life as a beautiful and elegant but old-fashioned Duc de Duras, an Indian man.
I would just like to point out my French is better than Dr.
Almost certainly. It started life as an Indian man, which is a large merchant vessel designed for long-distance travel. It had originally belonged to the French East India Company and was only given to Jones when the French Navy couldn't find a use for it. So the French Navy looked at it and
went, "He's got the sloppy seconds."
Yes.
It's like one of those houses that occasionally gets listed, and it's like 5 bedrooms, 3 bathrooms, you know, $200,000. And then you're like, what? What the hell? And then you go there, and you're like, what the, oh, this used to be a Hardee's. Like, oh, floor plan's all fucking weird. It's like, oh, it's our house is an old Dairy Queen. It's got like a weird roof. Yeah.
Why do you have to enter a passcode to get in the bathroom? Yeah.
It came with an assistant manager
named Chad.
Yeah, named Chad. He drives a Firebird and has a low-key coke problem.
So this ship was the slowest in the group that Jones would command. Mm-hmm. The Bahama Richard is
that
slower.
That must have pissed him off.
Let's go! Faster!
Sorry, Captain, we can't go any faster because... This is a bathtub that the French gave us. They gave us a bathtub that they fucked in once because they thought it was funny.
So it couldn't chase down prizes, right? It couldn't chase down British merchantmen to turn them into prizes, nor could it escape from British frigates, right?
Seems like two real important things.
Exactly.
It's like the two things you need to do.
Now, the name Bonhomme Richard requires a little bit of explanation. It is the closest the French could get to rendering Poor Richard in French from Ben Franklin's Poor Richard's Almanac.
Okay.
So that is why it is called that. They named it that in honor of Ben Franklin.
So many things. Just don't sneeze your fucking swine flu at me. All right. Anyway, so many things that the French give us, you're just like, is this a compliment or an insult? I guess we'll take it. Mm-hmm. And they're back home just like, they'll never know. No.
More broadly speaking, the French during the American Revolution, they would deploy 27 battalions to the Caribbean while only sending 9 battalions to America. This translates to they sent 26,865 men to the Caribbean to seize British sugar islands.
Yeah,
they sent 8,955 men to America.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, this is still the point in time where sugar was in fact worth more than gold by weight.
Yeah.
Like it's just like
So Jones was excited to have this large new command, and he worked with a will to bring the Richard up to strength. Mm-hmm. According to the naval historian Samuel Elliott Morrison, quote, Jones enjoyed fitting out ships more than anything except fighting and making love, end quote. He planned to arm her to the teeth.
Oh, I sure love making love. When I'm in the throes of passion, there's not that you can hear me for miles.
Someone next door goes, what are those bagpipes?
I wish I could do a good bagpipe impression.
It just sounded like a metal solo.
Bagpipe metal.
So in order,
that's our metal band, Death by Air Sack.
So he acquired 6 9-pounder guns.
We need sound effects for this episode, actually.
We are going to have to upgrade soundboard, our equipment. So, listeners, all two of you, I did do sound effects one episode. The problem is our particular high technology we're using. Think like the screen that Data or Geordi LaForge was looking at in Star Trek. That's our podcast equipment, so I'm still wrapping my head around it. So I've only been able to... There's only 4 options for sound effects. It's like a clap and like a honk, like...
beep, beep.
Yeah.
So he got 6 9-pounder guns, 28 12-pounder guns, and 6 heavy 18-pounder guns. He's got... Thank you.
That's one of them.
So this is 40 guns in all, right? He's got 40 guns. Unfortunately, he had to make do with older, less reliable guns because these are the ones the French were willing to part with.
Yeah, the kind that blow up.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool.
That will come into play later.
Foreshadowing.
He assembled a force of nearly 500 Marines total for his flotilla. Mm. He painted the hull black to disguise the number of gun ports, right? And he fortified the tops, what we might call the crow's nests, right? He fortifies those, and he added several swivel guns to the railings. These could be basically used as like shotguns when you get in close. So like he is intending to get in real close to enemy ships. He's going to disguise himself all the way in. He's brought on long way more Marines than you would normally bring. Mm-hmm.
And the boat was very goth.
Yes.
They rolled up just like, we're all stars now. You're the dope show.
This is the kind of music that really gets my blood boiling. After I have a lemon lime water, I just listen to Marilyn Manson. And I sometimes listen to Pantera, but the man doing my voice right now doesn't actually know any Pantera songs off the top of his head. So
to crew his ship, he gathered a veritable foreign legion. His crew was American and English, French, Irish, Scottish, Norwegian, Swiss, Italian, Bengali, Indian, and Portuguese.
And one sick-ass Transylvanian. All
right. I just love the ship is painted totally black, except the, like, nails on the little figure in the front are painted white or whatever. It's like a white face with black eyeliner. It'd be very cool.
His French Marines, all of whom were Irish.
Hang on. Let me just make sure I'm not having a stroke. Can you repeat that, please?
His French Marines, all of whom were Irish. Right. So they're wearing French military uniforms, but all of the recruits are from Ireland. The French do this through the entirety of the 1700s because they're like, hey, Irish Catholics, you know how you hate the British Protestant monarchy? Why don't you come fight for us? And so there are multiple regiments of the French army filled with Irish.
Well, bonjour then, sacre bleu, let's go.
So he had about 140 of these Marines aboard just his ship alone, right? He brings 500 Marines for all of the ships. 140 of them are on his, which is about three times the normal complement, right? Okay. You would normally have only about 30 or 40 Marines. He brings 140. They were an unruly bunch. Many of the British sailors had been recruited from French jails, and some of them had been imprisoned as mutineers. Mm. According to Evan Thomas in his book, John Paul Jones, quote...
Right, but they were reformed. The French prison system was big on reform at the time.
Definitely. So according to Thomas, quote, most of his men worshipped no god but rum and the lash, end quote. And in fact, Jones had to flog a large number of them immediately to show the crew who was in
rum
charge.
Rum and the lash. Mm-hmm.
They worshipped the
BDSM.
Lash? Yeah, that's 100% what I was thinking.
In this case, worship is being in awe of, I imagine. Mm-hmm. Being like the only thing.
Yeah, like when it hits your back, you go, oh.
Listeners, if you want to know about floggings in the 18th century, go back to our Hessian episode about the Cat of Nine Tails.
Yeah,
and
but Hessians are noms, so they didn't like it. Whereas Irish and French are obviously subs.
Definitely some leather daddies.
Yeah, yeah. The Irish and French are obviously subs. Like that's history, right?
So as one. Though as one French officer said of John Paul Jones, quote, he was always, though very strict and sharp in service, so while on duty, always strict and sharp, was affable, genteel, and very indulgent, not only toward his officers, but likewise towards the crew. So when you were on duty, Jones was a martinet. Mm-hmm. He was a very strict, demanding commander. But if you were off duty, this French officer who served alongside him went, you know, he wasn't like that off duty.
Hey boys, let me kick my boots off, you know? Like do we live to work or do we work to live? You know what I mean?
He might actually have said that with his fascination with enlightenment, self-improvement. Oh, so yeah. You may have actually like gotten to part of the man.
All right, fair enough.
So on August 14th, 1779, Jones left Lorient with 380 men aboard the Bonhomme Richard and the rest of the flotilla following him. Their mission was to distract the British while the Franco-Spanish fleet cleared the channel for a French invasion. The invasion never came to pass. Typhoid broke out in the fleet and it returned to port without any action. Right? Jones pressed on ahead anyway, right? But being the slowest in the group, the rest of the small fleet had to shorten their sails in order to let the Richard catch up. Speaking to your point earlier of being really, he must have been very annoyed.
Just sitting there like a cartoon character on the edge of the ship with the fucking smoke coming out of his ear.
And he takes his hat off and throws it on the deck and jumps up and down on it like Yosemite Sam. Now, with the original reason for sailing gone, discord cropped up between Jones and his other and his fellow captains. Jones wanted to seize British coastal towns and hold them hostage for the release of American prisoners of war. Mm-hmm. The other captains wanted to capture prizes, because that's how you made money.
It's true.
In the first 6 weeks, Jones gained nothing but a few prizes and the resentment of Captain Pierre Landais. Now, Captain Landais commanded the frigate Alliance. He's a French officer. Mm-hmm. He was a martinet, not uncommon for 18th century naval captains, an impoverished French noble, and an incompetent. On his way to France from America, his mostly American crew attempted to mutiny, and only the intervention of his passenger, the Marquis de Lafayette, saved him.
Oh, wow.
John Adams said of Captain Landais, quote, "There is in this man an inactivity and indecision that will ruin him. He is bewildered, an absent, bewildered man, an embarrassed mind," end quote. That's what John Adams said of this man.
Absent, so he's bewildered. He's either bewildered at how confused he is by the world or embarrassed by how bewildered he was.
He's just kind of dumb.
Oh, man, I almost feel bad for, you know, like he would have been like, I bet he was like a noble, but he was like, man, blacksmithery looks awesome. Like, I wish I could just hammer on something all day and think about the clouds.
So he and Jones were like oil and water. Landais claimed, by virtue of a congressional resolution, to be, quote, the only American, end quote, captain. So remember, Jones was born in Scotland. He wasn't born in America. Landais was born in France, but a congressional resolution had made him an American. And so he goes, I'm the only American captain in this group. And John Paul Jones did not like that.
Do you know how many American women I tried to get to marry me, you son of a bitch?
Did they have green cards at the time?
Jones said, quote, that's a damn lie, end quote. Now, Landais...
That's the most American thing to say, actually. It's like, yeah.
He immediately challenged Jones to a duel, but both put it aside for now, quote, for the good of the service, end quote. They would fight it when they get back to France. They go, when we get back to France, we'll fight our duel. For the time being, Landais would not come aboard the Bonhomme Richard for any reason. Mm-hmm. Just, he'd never come aboard. So on September 23rd...
He just didn't know how. I'd like to go talk to him about this, but it's just, you know, how would we even do it?
I don't understand how steps work.
Yeah, let's keep going. It's okay. I'm so embarrassed by how bewildered.
Yeah.
So on September 23rd, 1779, Jones spotted a convoy of British merchant vessels bound from Scandinavia, bringing naval stores to Britain off the coast, off a point of land called Flamborough Head.
Right. From Scandinavia?
Yes.
It was their flogging whips. The delivery of their sexy-ass leather outfits and their flogging whips. All right, go on. I'm sorry.
They really worship
the lash.
The lash.
They actually had oars like one of the old ancient ships, and it was like, du hast
mich. That's so German. Escorting this important convoy were two British warships, a sloop, the Countess of Scarborough, and a brand new, launched that year, 44-gun frigate Serapis. The latter was commanded by Captain Richard Pearson, Royal Navy. Pearson was a 30-year veteran who had held the rank of captain for the previous 6 years. While a junior officer, he had sailed a ship of the line through a hurricane. He had fought in three major fleet actions. He had stood at his post despite shattered ribs from French grape shot. Pearson would be a formidable foe. At 5 p.m., Jones, sailing under a British flag, normal procedure in the 1700s, Navy ships did this, British ships would fly under the flag of foreign powers, ordered beat to quarters, essentially battle stations, right? At 5 p.m., he orders his crew to battle station. This caused the sailors to prep the rigging for battle, for the surgeons to clear a space below deck for amputation, and for the gun crews and marines to race to their positions. Jones himself was neatly dressed, freshly shaved, and alert, despite having a severe lack of sleep, because again, he thinks everyone is trying to kill him.
Mm-hmm.
Jones signaled form line of battle to the rest of the squadron. No one joined him.
Oh, man. That is a real, like, we're all going to fucking quit, right, guys? Oh, shit, just me? Oh, no.
Who's coming with
me? Who's coming with me, man?
So whether from disobedience or incompetence, Bonhom Richard would face Serapis alone. As they drew closer, Jones saw Pearson personally nail the Royal Navy ensign to the flagstaff. This is where the term nail your flag to the mast comes from, right?
I'm sorry, what term?
To nail your colors to the mast.
Okay.
Right? It means like I will hold this position regardless,
yeah.
Right? Because you can't pull down a flag that has been nailed up. Oh, right? Like idea that I when Pearson is nailing the flag to the staff, what he is signaling is I will not surrender. Right? Mm. I have no intention of surrendering because I can't pull the colors down. Yeah.
Apologies, you said like the phrase, mm-hmm. and then said a phrase I've never heard before. So
fair enough. So Pearson had every right to confidently nail his colors to the mast. Serapis vastly outgunned Bonhom Richard. Richard had, as I stated earlier, 40 guns, 6 18-pounders, 28 12-pounders, and 6 9-pounders. The Serapis was a 44-gun ship that carried 20 18-pounders, 22 9-pounders, and 2 6-pounders. So when Serapis fired a broadside, so when Serapis fired all the guns on one side of the ship, it fired a total weight of 285 pounds. When the Richard fired back, the total weight was 265 pounds, right? So the weight of shot is always going to be on the side of Serapis. Mm-hmm. The British crews prided themselves on being able to fire two broadsides to their opponent's one. In this case, 570 pounds of ordnance fired from British guns for every 265 pounds fired from Jones's crew.
Mm.
This would certainly be true against the Americans, who had so little gunpowder that gunnery drills largely consisted of the guns running out and pretending to fire them. So you would run the guns out, pretend to fire them, and go through all the motions of reloading. Add to this the fact that Jones's 18-pounders were old and that French guns had a reputation for bursting, that is, exploding when they fire.
I'm sorry, this never happens. This has never happened to me before.
It was not going to be an even fight. Jones would have to win through tactics and cunning, not firepower. So Jones ordered his 18-pounders to aim for the British hull. Right, to put holes in her below the waterline to try to sink her. To his 12-pounder gun crews, he ordered them to load double shot, that is, put two cannonballs in instead of one, and aim for the rigging to disable the Serapis.
They would put like chains between those sometimes.
Sometimes, right? Yes, okay. If you had them. Yeah, if you had them. I don't think Jones...
But double shot, it still is just an extra chance it might hit the rigging.
Yeah, yeah, or if you might hit the rigging and the mast, mm-hmm. right? Like, it's to disable the ship. And then the 9-pounders were to cut up the rigging and sails. Jones ordered his marines to the quarterdeck and to the top. So the quarterdeck is the rear of the ship.
Mm-hmm.
Their job was to rake the deck of Serapis and clear it, right? He goes, I don't want a single living soul above decks, basically. To do this, they had muskets, swivel guns, blunderbusses, and small mortars, as well as grenades. Oof. Yeah, the marines, officers, and the tops were young. The oldest... being in his early 20s, and two of them were 17. Two of the Marine officers with Jones are 17.
And they stood there the whole time going,
we're on the Bonhom Richard.
Yeah, the Bonhom Richard. I just love that Beavis and Butthead lived throughout history. Anyway, go on.
Is Nixon chasing them while Churchill chases Nixon? Like, what's going on?
It's Nixon. Those goddamn kids been walking in my trap.
So each Marine got a double allowance of grog before going up. Finally, the armory was unlocked to hand out weapons for a boarding party, and Jones himself would stand on the quarterdeck, exposed to fire. The quarterdeck is at the stern of the ship, as I said, at the back of the ship, and it's where it's steered from, and it possesses no cover. There is nowhere to hide on the quarterdeck of a ship. In the case of the Bonhom Richard, the quarterdeck was probably an open space of about 400 square feet,
okay.
Right? Like total size. Mm. So sailing ships of the late 18th century moved at a painfully slow pace. So while Jones beat to quarters at 5 p.m., he did not close with Serapis until 7 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And as the two ships closed, Captain Pearson shouted out, apparently in a very haughty English voice, quote, "This is His Majesty's ship, Serapis. What ship is that?" End quote. Jones replied, "The Princess Royal," which was a real East India ship that looked a bit like the Bohem Richard. Unconvinced, Pearson asked, "Where from?" To which Jones feigned to not be able to hear the question.
Mm-hmm.
Pearson, at the end of his patience, yelled, quote, "Tell me instantly from whence you came and who you be, or I'll fire a broadside into you," end quote. Jones, like my favorite scoundrel from a galaxy far, far away, decided that this was a boring conversation anyway and ran up the American flag. An eerie calm descended between the two ships. At 7:15 p.m., a marine in the tops nervously fired his musket, and both ships fired broadsides at the same time. According to Jones, quote, "The battle thus begun was continued with unremitting fury," end quote. Now, I want you to imagine this scene.
Okay? They always say that, too. It's like as if some like leader of a military party would be like, it was chill. Like, it was a super chill battle. They didn't even try that hard. It was easy. You know?
Yeah, you have to write in that kind of detached style. Yeah. No military leader has ever written a report that goes, and I was shitting my pants the whole time. That just doesn't happen.
Well, or like even when it's like it was actually an unbelievably easy battle, mm-hmm. like for instance, like the British in like South Africa, and they would still write like the fury at which our enemy came upon us, and it's like, didn't you lose one guy to like 20,000? What the fuck are you talking about, you psycho? Anyway, yes.
So I want you to imagine this scene. September 23rd, 1779 was a clear day with a light wind and calm seas, right? And the sun is about to go down, right? And around 7:20 p.m., a second broadside erupted from Serapis and Bohem Richard. They both fire again. This one was even more explosive than the first because aboard Bohem Richard, the decks were rocked by a massive explosion. One or maybe two of her 18-pounders burst. That is, they failed explosively. On the second shot of the battle, one or two of them blow up.
I promise you.
This ripped out a part of the hull below the waterline, right? Because the heavier the guns are, the lower they go in the ship.
Mm-hmm. For ballast.
Yeah. So the battle was only 15 minutes old, and already Richard was taking on water.
Oh.
Jones abandoned the remaining 18-pounders. So he's like, can't use those anymore. He had lost his most powerful guns. The British poured yet another broadside into the Americans. Jones had decided to be aggressive and put Serapis on the defensive. However, Pearson's long experience as a Royal Navy officer showed when, at 7:30 p.m., he allowed the Bohem...
How close are they to each other?
They are within 50 yards of each other.
Okay. So they're just like sitting in the water, shooting cannons at each other.
Yes, at close range.
At close range.
Yes.
I don't know how you did it back then.
Yeah, and I haven't.
I have no idea how.
I haven't mentioned this because it didn't seem important when I was reading it, but it might be important now, which is that John Paul Jones will state on multiple occasions in multiple actions, he will tell his crew to get within pistol shot. And we were discussing the range of muskets earlier, yards. A pistol's range is like 25 yards.
Yeah, yeah.
So to get within pistol shot of an enemy ship means you are almost touching. And then you're firing these guns that are, you know.
They shoot nails for like blunderbusses.
Yeah.
Shoot like,
well, and, but even like the, you know, when you're talking about an 18 pounder, what you're talking about is a.
Not a podcast episode.
We were doing, you know what? I am moving the challenge over. I have won the challenge of not doing dirty jokes on the podcast for a single episode. I challenge you. What do you want to not hit the fucking microphone for one whole episode? What do you want? What are your demands?
ADDs work in different ways.
That's actually
mine
really true.
Involves hitting shit. I don't know.
That is actually true. We all have a unique blend of ADHD. Dr. History Moral Scholars allows him to... if you've ever seen that meme where that you reach pure enlightenment and the lines on, he got the good ADHD, turns out. He got the bad.
But the idea being that, like, if you're firing an 18-pounder gun, what you're firing is an 18... You're firing the heaviest bowling ball you can find at somebody at several hundred miles per hour. Sort of thing.
Oh.
Now, Pearson's experience as
wouldn't it just hit them in the belly and bounce off like those old black and white videos of fat guys?
It would hit them in the belly. It would not bounce off.
Oh, no.
There wouldn't be much left of the guy or his belly. Now, Pearson's experience as a Royal Navy officer showed when at 7:30 he allowed the Richard to pull ahead of him. Right, he lets him get in front of him, and then Pearson ordered a fractional change of course and conducted the ultimate 18th century naval maneuver. He raked the stern. He fires a broadside into the back mm-hmm. of the Richard. Mm. Right now, what this means is that he imagined 285 pounds of iron and lead. Remember, that's the weight of his broadside. It goes in one end of the ship and sails down the entire length of the ship mm-hmm. to the other side.
Yeah. Right. It's like if you're looking at troops mm-hmm. on the ground, it'd mm-hmm. be like if you flank troops and fire through like yes. a diagonal line. Like yeah. it's yeah mm-hmm. yeah. Then was that considered crossing the T?
Yeah, that's the same concept.
Same
yeah.
concept. Yeah.
So the effects of this were catastrophic. Guns were dismounted from their gun carriages, which is no mean feat when you consider an 18th century naval gun weighed a couple of tons. Mm-hmm. And men were ripped into bloody rags. Oof. 22 Yikes. Of the 25 Marines stationed on the quarterdeck were made into casualties. So 22 of the 25 Marines standing around Jones had been hit by cannon Yikes. Fire. The surgeon was soon overwhelmed. Serapis was firing a broadside every 90 seconds to 2 minutes. Bonhomme Richard was holed below the waterline, and the carpenters and pumps were barely able to cope. Jones was losing. Quote, I confess that the enemy's ship, being much more manageable than the Bonhomme Richard, gained thereby several times in an advantageous situation in spite of my best endeavors to prevent it. Mm-hmm. End quote. Basically, his ship was better than mine, and even though I tried really hard, he keeps finding himself in a better spot than me.
Yeah, I mean, I thought they were trying to avoid direct showdowns with the British Navy.
So he... Probably, but he also assumed that he was going to have four more ships following in right behind him.
Yeah, there was that.
He thought it was going to be like a 5-on-1 battle, and then none of the other ships showed up. So all the while, he stood on the quarterdeck thinking through what to do next, right? He's on the quarterdeck the whole time. Pearson was not one to play with his food, so at 8 p.m., he attempted to go in for the kill. He had raked the stern of Bonhomme Richard. Now he would rake the bow, that is the front. He was going to, if he did the same maneuver again from the front, and he would hopefully ignite a magazine, mm-hmm. right? Ignite the gunpowder and force Jones to strike his colors. However, God or luck was on Jones's side, and the wind failed in the middle of attempting to cross Bonhomme Richard's bow, and he thus rams the Serapis, right? Jones exclaimed to his crew, quote, well done, my lads, we've got her now, end quote. He ordered up a boarding...
Well done, my lads, we've got her now. Let's be just historically accurate about this.
That's fair.
Well done, my lads, we've got her now. Did he just say something? Charge! I like to think that John Paul Jones is like the Forrest Gump of the Revolutionary War. Like he just finds himself everywhere and did an okay job and was an all right guy, but like really he wasn't moving the levers of history. Yeah.
So he ordered a boarding party to hurl grappling hooks to bring the ships together. However, Royal Marines fought them off and the two ships disengaged. In the process, Serapis fired again. By now, the Bonhomme Richard's decks were awash in blood. Jones needed to regain the initiative. Quote, it was my intention to lay the Bonhomme Richard athwart the enemy's bow. He's going to try to do the same thing to the Serapis. He planned to rake Serapis just as she had done to him. At 8:30 p.m., Bonhomme Richard made her final course change to cross the T of Serapis. Earlier in the battle, some of the braces, blocks, and tackles for the rigging had been shot away. And suddenly Jones found himself stalled in front of the Serapis. Pearson was a good sailor. His crew was well trained, and the Serapis was a nimble ship, but none of them could beat the laws of physics. Serapis rammed Bonhomme Richard. The two ships were now trapped together.
Whoa.
Jones decided to make the most of this situation and ordered one of his senior sailors to lash the ships together.
Right.
This man, in classic sailor fashion, began swearing creatively and profusely. Jones responded mockingly, quote, Mr. Stacy, it's no time to be swearing now. You may be in the next moment, be in eternity. but let us do our duty, end quote. Basically, like, don't take the Lord's name in vain. You might be seeing him soon.
Yeah. He's going to be mad about that. Yeah. He's not going to like it. I don't
know if you know this, but God doesn't like it if you talk that way. Charge!
Now, Serap has tried...
I love this fucking guy. John Paul Jones is like David the Gnome of Navy captains. I don't know what to, like, I don't know what to make of him one way. He almost seems like he feels like Paul Rudd's character in Avengers.
Oh, Ant-Man?
Yeah, where he's just kind of like, I'm here. Doesn't anyone see? I'm here. I'm a superhero too.
Jones was making fun of a sailor for swearing. And Serapis tried to break free, but failed to do so. So the muzzles of the two ships were now more or less together and continuing, and they kept firing. So these ships are, like you were saying, how close are they? They had been like 30 yards apart. No. They are now basically touching and firing into touching. Each other.
So is there like a second deck guy with a cannon just firing like 5 feet away to yes. another second deck
yes.
guy with a cannon?
That's they were cool. essentially docking.
that's where that comes from.
But this is a real chicken of the egg. You know what? Let's dig into this. This is a real chicken of the egg situation, you know, because it's sailors, right? So it's like, what came first, docking or docking? That's
very funny. So the Marines in the tops of the Bonhom Richard kept the Serapis from cutting free.
They cross swords. Is that a better is that a better analogy?
So they kept
so, all right, we'll move on. Since
what other dick metaphors would you like?
Oh no, they have apparently beholden Richard. Over and over, they have fired into the beholden Richard. How many rounds will they put into the beholden Richard? We cannot. Quick. Carl.
Some of which came from the rear.
That sounds so much.
Anyway, so the Marines stationed in the tops of the Richard kept Serapis from cutting free by shooting anything that moved across her decks. By 9 p.m., with the sun dipping below the horizon, the battle had devolved into two separate fights, one above and one below. Above, the Marines cleared the Serapis' deck, even forcing Pearson to leave the quarterdeck, which is an impressive achievement for that time, to get the captain of a ship to...
Just have to retreat, basically.
And yeah, to take the entirely sane precaution of putting something between him and the pounds of iron and lead people are throwing at him while you're wearing the gaudiest uniform. Yeah, like, there is no way that an Irish-French-American Marine in 1779...
Irish-French-American Moroccan-Egyptian Chinese-Japanese Marine.
How many hyphens can we get?
but the idea that any one of them was confused as to who the captain of the Serapis was ridiculous, right? He is the guy in the nice blue coat.
I feel like 95% of the time you can just be like the one with the fucking feather. It's like no one else on the ship owns a feather. You know, except that one guy in his dumb fucking hat.
So that's the one fight is above, right? Where the Richard is winning, right? The other below, Serapis blasted away. Most of their shot went through and through. That is, it went in one side of the Bonhomme.
So they're stuck together and they're shooting at each other.
So if you sink one of the ships, it'll sink the other, right?
Well, so the idea is if you sink one, if the Richard starts to sink, it probably won't stop you from cutting away.
Oh,
right? Okay. Like, that's the idea. So I think Pearson's plan is, if I just blow the Bonhomme Richard away, if I kill most of her crew, I can cut free and leave. Okay. But most of his shots are going all the way through the Richard. They're going in one side and out the other.
They keep trying to hit me, but I'm too short.
The Bonhomme Richard's gun deck became a slaughterhouse. By this point, Jones had lost all of his 12-pounder guns. So all of his 12-pounder guns are gone. And he had only 3 9-pounders left on the quarterdeck. Both ships are on fire. And finally, the Alliance, under the command of the mercurial Captain Londai, arrived at the battle. Now, Jones...
Repeat the ship and the captain name?
alliance under Captain Landai.
And that's the guy he hated, the French guy he hated. Oh, he's going to swoop in, isn't he?
So Jones had been looking for his squadron throughout the battle. He saw Pallas defeat the Countess of Scarborough, but that wasn't a very impressive feat. Vengeance and Cerf were nowhere to be seen. He did not know where they went. Just then, Alliance passed by and raked both Serapis and Bonhomme Richard with Grape Shot. Oh. He fires Grape Shot into both ships.
What a dick.
Quote, "For God's sake, wrong ship, stop firing," end quote, was the cry from the Americans.
I'm sorry.
Same team, bro.
I don't hear what you're saying in your terrible language. Fire!
Alliance sailed by and put yet another broadside of Grape Shot into Bonhomme Richard and then sailed into the night. Jones was livid.
Jones is like, dick! Like, what are you fucking dick? What the hell, bro?
So he, in the middle of battle, instructed some of his crew to put additional lanterns in a prearranged signal that would indicate that he was their Commodore. Mm. It was 9:15 p.m. So at 9:15, he puts up lanterns in a prearranged signal that every American ship, every ship in his squadron should understand, this is the Commodore's ship, right? Now, the Bonhomme Richard was now sinking. Mm-hmm. Jones was working on a remaining 9-pounder gun on the quarterdeck when a young officer, thinking that Jones was dead, couldn't find him, and that he was the last officer of the ship, attempted to surrender or ask for quarter. Right? He starts shouting to the British that we surrender. Jones flew into a rage. Quote, "Quarters! Who are those rascals? Shoot them! Kill them!" End quote. Jones pulls out a pistol and fires. Click. It was empty from an attempt to kill a British officer earlier in the battle. So he flipped it around to hold it by the barrel and threw it at the officer attempting to surrender. He hits him in the head, knocking him out. The British...
That rules. That actually rules. You can flip the gun around and just throw it.
Like, yeah! Right.
I'm going to slowly...
For our Gen Z listener, yeet.
Yeah, he... I think... Anyway, I don't know. Is that Gen Z? Is
I have no idea all right, what it is enough. Anymore. I'm just old.
Yeah. I lost the train on that one.
Now, the British heard the young officer and asked Jones if he was going to surrender, right? They hear this at this call for quarter. And so another junior officer recollected 45 years later. In his old age, he remembers the iconic response, quote, "I have not yet begun the flight."
Oh, this is where it comes out.
So it's unfortunate that this is probably not true. Jones probably didn't say that. Now, Jones would write in his official report that he answered, quote, "in the most determined negative," end quote. So the British did ask him, are you going to surrender? He says, I said in the most determined negative, which doesn't say much, right? That leaves the substance of the quote.
Yeah, vague. You could have been like, nope.
Or you could have been like, fuck no. You know,
you couldn't know.
Now, to Louis XVI, after the battle, he claimed to have said, quote, "I haven't as yet thought of surrendering, but I am determined to make you ask for quarter," end quote. And even by the windy standards of the 1700s, this seems unlikely to have been said in the middle of battle. So the most...
Two listeners, don't worry. I just will be quarantined the next month and we'll have sores. It's monkeypox. Rex has monkeypox.
One of them.
I have one monkeypox at the moment.
So the most likely formulation is, in fact, I think, the best. Right? This is the formulation that is most likely. Quote, "I may sink, but I'll be damned if I strike," end quote. The battle continued. So basically he's saying, I might sink, strike my colors.
Oh,
I'm not going to surrender. I may sink, but I will not surrender.
Okay.
So the battle continued, and a possible second front opened up on Jones. So the Bonhomme Richard carried about 100 prisoners of war from the previous weeks of commerce raiding. Mm. Right? So they'd taken aboard British prisoners. They were locked below decks, an area that was fast filling with water. Now, the master at arms, hearing their cries of desperation, let them out rather than let them drown. At this point, they probably could have seized the ship and ended the battle, but they were so frightened of fire and sinking that they were actually persuaded into helping man the pumps. So all of these prisoners end up helping to keep the ship going. At 9:45 p.m., the British attempted to board Bonhomme Richard and end the battle. They were met by Jones himself, holding a boarding pike, and he and his crew drove them back. The battle still continued. At 10 p.m., the Alliance drifted back into the battle under the command of Captain Landais.
I hate this guy so much.
Now, September 23rd, the moon was bright. The bright moon. No clouds. Lots of visibility. Bonhomme Richard had put up those signal lanterns to say, this is the Commodore's ship. Serapis and Bonhomme Richard were painted differently, right? The Richard is painted black. The Serapis was painted bright yellow. British ships are painted in a bright yellow pattern. And yet Alliance poured one more broadside of grape shot into both ships. Jones was beginning to think it was intentional.
I'm starting to think that he's doing this on purpose, you guys. What do you think?
No, he wouldn't do that. No.
Did we kill that little Scottish pig? No. Damn. Mad.
That's my, like, oh,
that's
French.
Your French. Okay. Yeah. I was like, why is he doing a Chicago accent?
You can cut that out. That's fine.
I will not.
So by 10:15, the battle was entering its third hour. By this point, the Marines had won the battle for the tops, right? So they'd cleared the Serapis's deck, while the British had won the artillery duel, right? The British are winning below decks.
So the butthole is sinking.
Yes.
The
Bonhomme Richard.
The Bonhomme Richard is sinking. Mm-hmm. But they have the top deck of the British ship. Like, literally, basically, if anyone cleared. Comes up the stairs, they'll get shot or whatever. Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
So an intrepid Scottish sailor, William Hamilton, climbed out on the spar of the main mast of the Bonhomme Richard with a lit match and a bag full of grenades. As he peered over the devastated deck of the Serapis, he found an open hatch. Taking a deep breath, he aimed and dropped one of his grenades into the hatch. A few moments later, he was rewarded by a massive explosion. He had hit the ready-use ammunition for the Serapis' gun crews.
Ooh.
So the explosion was the result of a violation of Royal Navy rules. Gunpowder was not supposed to be piled up like that, but after hours of fighting, the Powder Monkeys, which is the... There are boys aboard ships. Like, they are between the ages of 8 and 12, and they're... Nickname in battle is Powder Monkeys. They run between the guns and the magazine, filling up bags of gunpowder to bring back to the guns. So they had grown tired, right, after running back and forth for 3 hours. And what they had done is they'd started stacking up ammunition, right, so that it would be easier to distribute, rather than run all the way down and all the way up for every single cartridge.
But how long has this battle been going on?
Just over 3 hours, right?
And they've been attached. They've been docking.
For like the last hour, 2 hours.
They've been crossing swords for
Honestly, if you dock for that long, there's got to be a lot of chafing.
Yeah, you probably should see a doctor.
Yeah, yeah. Is there any sort of lubrication between the two ships?
Just gunpowder. Just so much powder. Which is the opposite of what you want in this situation.
Yeah, no, you don't want gunpowder in a docking situation.
So the effect of the explosion was a fire that ripped through the gun deck. Just leaving him hanging.
I know. I was going to pound you for that. I really like the docking joke. I'm still thinking about it. Anyway.
So the effect of this explosion was a fire that ripped through the gun deck that was packed with men. Serapis lost 5 of its guns, its main mast, and half of its remaining crew. Oof. And with it, the battle. The ship was on fire in a dozen places, and Captain Pearson called out that he was surrendering his ship. It was now 10:30 p.m. Pearson cried out, quote, "Sir, I have struck. I ask for quarter," end quote. Jones responded, quote, "If you have struck, haul down your ensign," end quote. Pearson ripped down the British flag that he had so confidently nailed to the flagstaff. The firing stopped, and Pearson came aboard Bonhomme Richard to hand over his sword. Quote, "Sir, you have fought like a hero," end quote. That's what Jones tells Pearson. Yeah. Jones says, "You have fought like a hero and returned his sword. You can keep it."
That was kind of a relatively common thing back then, because it was like nobility would be like respect each other's courage or whatever.
But also there's the fact that especially within the Navy and within the middle ranks of the army, even if you're a noble, you're probably not that wealthy, and you had to buy your own sword.
No shit, really?
Yeah.
So it's like, listen, I would love to take this from you, but like,
I know that it will cost you like half a year's salary to buy a new one.
I'm assuming you bought this on layaway. So.
Yeah. No, like, I mean, it's a thing. You know, when one of the reasons
I thought they were being like cool and honorable.
So that is part of it. Like it comes from that, mm-hmm. but it is there's another aspect of it, which is that, like, for instance, to use two other examples from the American Revolution, at the Battle of Saratoga, Horatio Gates, the American general, gives the British general, General Burgoyne, his sword back,
mm-hmm.
right? Burgoyne comes from a relatively middle-class background, and Gates had been a part of the British army, so they probably had known each other before the war. And he's like, I kind of know, and he's also being like kind of cool about it. When Earl Cornwallis surrenders his sword to George Washington, Washington does not give Earl Cornwallis his sword.
This is a very nice sword. I think I'll put it above my mantle forever.
Yeah. Actually, it's even cooler than that.
No shit.
Because Earl Cornwallis at Yorktown, it's unclear, but he was, I'm putting this in air quotes, sick at the surrender.
Mm.
It's possible he was sick because he'd been under siege for like a month. Yeah, so it is possible, but it's also possible that he's being like, I don't want to go out and do it.
Yeah.
It would be really, it's already embarrassing to surrender. Now imagine embarrassing and then surrendering and then just shitting your pants immediately.
Exactly. Yeah,
yeah, you don't want to do that.
So instead,
dysentery will do that.
To a colony.
Instead he sends out his second in command, Charles O'Hara, to surrender his sword. Gives him his sword and says, go surrender this to the French and Americans. And O'Hara comes out and he tries to surrender it to Rochambeau. To the French general. He tries to give Cornwallis's sword to Rochambeau. And Rochambeau's aide-de-camp goes, you've made a mistake, sir. The commander-in-chief of our armies is on the right, not the left.
Mm-hmm.
And so O'Hara turns around and tries to surrender it to Washington. And Washington goes, but you're the second in command. And so instead he points to his second in command, Benjamin Lincoln. So you have to imagine Charles O'Hara is like attempting to give this sword that isn't
They're
his.
They're all just being so fucking petty. Just take the goddamn sword, you absolute assholes. Just what? Like, no, not me. If you give me the sword, it'll have some weird fucking meaning that no one understands. So give him the sword. Well, oh, no, not me.
And Charles O'Hara also surrendered to Napoleon. So he's the only British general who has the dubious honor of surrendering to both of George Washington and Napoleon Bonaparte.
Wow.
But anyway, so Jones gives him back his sword, and Pearson asked about the crew of the Bonhomme Richard that had defeated him. And Jones lied and said it was mostly Americans, right? Remember, I gave you that long list of nationalities. And Pearson responded, quote, then it was diamond cut by diamond, end quote. Maybe a third of Bonhomme Richard's crew was American-born.
Oh.
So it's the idea that, you know, the Americans and the British aren't that different. You know, diamond cut diamond. If he had told him that there were French and Portuguese and Indians and Bengalis, Pearson may have immediately jumped into the ocean.
Well, all right. So why didn't he? That would have been rad. You know, oh, my God. That's so, like...
Yeah. No, it's...
I hate it. Yeah. I hate it very much. And... The other thing, I mean, this like the whitewashing of history happens all the time. I mean, we talked about Bass Reeves, and I've looked at this a couple of different times now. I thought originally the estimate was a quarter, but apparently it's 50%. Above 50% of anyone during the Wild West you would have considered a cowboy was black or brown.
Yeah.
Right? Probably. But like now look at every single Hollywood movie of all time. The West is just filled with just crackers.
Yeah.
And not just, but the waspiest.
Yep.
Yeah. And they like dress them down like, and they're spitting tobacco or whatever. But like, imagine every Hollywood Western you've seen from 1945 all the way to 1979.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Every single town is filled with white people. 100%.
Yeah.
And the same thing. Yeah. All of these white ship crews. White.
White. It's a white.
Well, and it's especially true of the American Navy and then of merchant navies. Right. Because. Because
you go where the money is.
Yeah. Well, and also there isn't as much of a. For instance, the British Navy is a third Irish or more. which becomes a problem at various points.
Don't tell the French. They'll never let us live it down.
It's not even that. Yeah. It's more that the Irish don't like being British. And it's because it's not a third of the officers of the Royal Navy.
Oh, yeah.
It's a third of the sailors of the British Navy are Irish. Yeah. But you do have the fact that, like, with most European navies in the 1700s, they're going to be more or less from the home country because it's, like, a national security issue, right? But, yeah, like, the idea that you know, sailors aboard merchant vessels are all from the country. No, they're filled with people from all over.
Think of every cruise ship ever. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the exact same thing. It's like, who's here? Who wants to, like, who has the ability in their life to be out at sea for 6 months,
eight months?
Yeah, yeah, most of the year.
Joke, there's the joke from Brooklyn Nine-Nine that most of them are criminals.
What?
That most people who work on a cruise ship are criminals. And the captain of the cruise ship goes, I myself am a tax evader.
Yeah, exactly.
But the Battle of Flamborough Head, this battle between the Serapis and Bonhomme Richard, had been a bloodbath.
Mm-hmm.
Serapis had started with a crew of about 270. The Richard had started with a crew of about 320.
The what?
The Bonhomme Richard.
Oh, okay, the Bonhomme Richard. Got it.
The total losses have never been exactly determined, but most estimates are about 50% of both crews are made into casualties.
Oof.
And this is an abnormally high percentage for a single ship engagement.
Yeah, yeah.
And the reason is that if you're for fleet engagements, 50% losses is pretty normal or more normal.
Because you might lose a whole ship.
But it isn't just... that's true. That's part of it.
Mm-hmm.
The reason single ship battles aren't necessarily this bloody is the weird politics of honor coupled with the hierarchical command structure. So in a fleet action, you can't leave the line of battle. You can't run away. You are stuck.
Mm-hmm.
If you run, the admiral will know that you run, and all of the other captains will know that you've run.
Mm.
But if you're in a single ship engagement and you run away, the only people who know you ran away are the enemy. Nobody cares what they think.
Right, right.
And your junior officers. Are your junior officers going to... They're not going to say shit.
They probably were being like, we should run. We should run.
Even if they don't say you do have examples of this, of captains and junior officers being like, our captain may have been a coward, but like, it would be career suicide to accuse your commanding officer of cowardice.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right? Because you can't prove it. Right? That's the problem is getting the proof. So the fact that two ships...
Well, you could just ask the Irish.
We don't trust.
No, we don't. I've got 24 Irish crew members
that
heard him say
that.
So you
have half an opinion.
Yeah, you have 49% of one person. This is a joke against the British. I want to be very clear about that.
So, but the point being that the idea that two ships would fight to the point where, because this kind of action during, like, say, the Battle of Trafalgar, which is one of the largest naval battles. In this period of time in the Napoleonic Wars, you might get to this level of casualties because you're sitting in a line with the other ships for hours and hours and hours, and you can't leave because Admiral Nelson, the greatest admiral in the history of the British Navy, is looking at you with his only one eye.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and
he only had one eye.
He did. He's where we get the phrase turn a blind eye.
Oh.
Because he commanded one part of a British fleet during a battle, the first part of the fleet, and they were engaged. And the commander of the British fleet told him to withdraw, and the captain of his ship says, "Sir, they're signaling us to withdraw." And he goes, "Give me your telescope," and he gives him the telescope, and he puts it up to his blind eye and goes, "I don't see an order to withdraw. Continue the attack." So that's where turning a blind eye to something comes from.
Nice.
So,
Ma.
So the battle ended just in time for Jones, with the a fire on the Bonhomme Richard was close. The battle ends just in time for Jones, right? If the battle had gone on any longer, he may have lost, because the fire on the Bonhomme Richard was close to exploding his ship's magazine, right? It was getting close to the gunpowder on his ship. The entire crew, plus the British prisoners, helped to put out the fire. Bonhomme Richard had won the battle, but she was finished. She sank on September 24th, 1779, with her colors still flying.
Mm.
The crew, the prisoners, and the wounded were transferred to Serapis and the other ships in the flotilla because they'd all come back after the battle was won.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did we miss something here? We saw a very pretty woman in the distance, so we had to chase her. Was there a battle?
I don't know what happened to all of our extra grape shot. We fired him.
Yeah, well, that guy, we'll talk about him.
So Jones moved his flag, that is command of the squadron, to Serapis, where he watched his old flagship sink, quote, with inexpressible grief, end quote. Next time,
that's gotta be bullshit.
Yeah.
He hated that ship. It was slow as fuck, and he didn't even like it. Now he's got a sick-ass British ship that all he has to do is fix up.
But I think for him, the issue is that this is the greatest moment of his life to this point, right? I think he's looking at it through rose-colored glasses in the sense of, like,
beat the British.
He took on a state-of-the-art British frigate. The ship Serapis had been launched in 1779, right? It's not like for instance, the flagship that Nelson has at Trafalgar in 1805 is the HMS Victory. Victory had been built in the 1760s, right? So by the Battle of Trafalgar, the Victory is like 40 years old, but technology didn't move as fast, so it wasn't like, but there were pieces of it that were like, you probably would have looked at it in 1805 and been like, if we were building the ship today, we wouldn't have built it that way. But Serapis had been built that year, right? And he had beat it with this old piece of shit that the French had given him. So he's like, if I could do that, right, you know, I do think there was a degree of seriousness to it. I think, yes, you're absolutely right. He was annoyed with how slow it was and how crappy the guns were. But I think it's the idea that this is, again, the highest point of his life to that point.
Yeah.
And the ship he wanted in is sinking. And I think that did awaken some real emotion in him.
Like, he got a little lucky in that battle.
I mean, yeah, you know, as Napoleon said, I give a commander who's good or lucky, I'll take the one who's lucky, right? Yeah. You know?
I mean, there's probably not too many. I've talked about them all the time, but like, of all the commanders that you could say is like mostly skill, it's like probably Genghis Khan and probably Hannibal. But like, I mean, Napoleon got lucky a bunch of times. Yeah,
he admitted that.
Yeah, luck is part of.
Yeah, you know. It's luck, and it's, you know, the fact that, like, if you were raiding the two ships themselves before the battle, you would have given Serapis at least 2-1 odds of winning, right? If you were placing bets on it, right? But that's why, you know, it's why you fight the battles, as it were, right?
Just a little shout out to Will. It's almost like Any Given Sunday.
That's a callback, baby! So what did we learn?
What'd you learn?
It's
hard to learn when you have a deadly infectious disease.
I learned when two ships dock, it's a very special moment.
There's going to be fireworks. There's going to be friction. And honestly, so much semen.
A wash
of semen everywhere.
But also blood.
Yeah. Washed in semen blood. Okay.
That Dr. History Moral Scholar made it dark with the blood content. We found out this episode that his parents listened.
You have a very lovely son, Mr. and Mrs. Dr. History Scholar.
Yeah, he's one of the best. He really is one of the best. Oh, can I give my lesson learned? I get it. It's a callback, but Any Given Sunday, baby. I'm telling you, like, because again, it's like I joked. I think it was the last episode. I joked about how much better British captains were than American captains. So it's almost sort of like, even the fact that John Paul Jones can like compete in the big leagues is sort of something to be said in and of itself. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's just like,
This is the first victory of a American ship against a British ship that is even remotely the same size, right? Like, he had delivered the first victory, which was in the last episode, but he outgunned that British ship. This is and until the end
this
of
this is the first outright victory.
Yes, of an American ship over a British victory. And there won't be another one until the end of the war.
Oh.
Until after Yorktown, end of war, okay. Kind of thing. So what I said is that indirect warfare is not a catch-all, right? It does not win wars. So a state cannot win a war simply by attacking around the edges.
Mm-hmm.
No matter how successful Jones was, it came down to the fact that George Washington and the Continental Army won decisive victories in America.
Sure.
That won the war. Right. So I agree with both of you. It's very impressive that he wins this battle. Strategically, it doesn't change mean much.
Yeah.
It doesn't. It's a fun. It's an interesting story.
It's really more of a diversion for the British.
Exactly.
Right?
Like and
a minor diversion.
Exactly. And it's a diversion that they could have overcome, right, if they had beaten Washington in the field,
mm-hmm.
right? Like if they had destroyed Washington's army at a certain point in the war, it wouldn't have mattered that the Bonhomme Richard defeated the Serapis off Flamborough Head, right? Because they also don't take that convoy gets into port safely. The convoy that the Serapis was defending.
That they're actually fighting
for? Yeah, gets away.
It did take 3.5 hours exactly, to fight the battle, yeah. So the convoy is like, deuces.
Yeah.
Left, yeah.
Yeah. So next we'll discuss the rest of Jones's life.
All right, that's been our episode, part three?
Correct.
Yes, it
is. Okay, we're in part three, and so we're going to have part four next. And that's been our episode. You can follow us if you have any questions, Instagram, laughing hist, and on Twitter. If you have any questions for Dr. Hirschi Sage Scholar, he loves to answer questions.
Please ask those questions, like, share, five stars.
Yes,
because
yeah.
I want to pay him. I want to pay Dr. History Scholar, but I can't yet because you guys, dear two listeners, don't like his show.
We're going to have this discussion next time.
Yeah. And when you do it, stare deeply into Adam Lex's mustache. You will be hypnotized.
Not into his eyes. You don't want to do that.
No.
There's only darkness there. So I've been watching a lot of Rings of Power, which is why there's only darkness there. They say that a lot. So I guess.
Yep, that's our episode.
That's our show.
Yeah.